This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this Resolution Foundation webinar. We're here to talk about the labour market today, and not just about the labour market right here, right now, but what the lessons are for the future of the world of work in Britain and for how this post-crisis decade looks from what we can see in the data that is happening right here, right now. And we're doing that because one of the lessons of those that have been around too long through multiple recessions is that the legacies of different recessions are not always the same. And the unemployment legacy of the 80s and 90s or the low pay legacy of the financial crisis won't necessarily be the same legacy that we face after this crisis. And so looking at not just at history, but at the now is important for thinking for the future. So that's the overall plan. To help us do that, you're first of all going to hear from Hannah Slaughter, who's the author of a big report we've got out this morning as part of the inquiry, Economy 2030 inquiry that ourselves and LSE are doing with the generous funding of the Nuffield Foundation. She's going to give you the headlines of that report. You should obviously all read the whole report, all 70 pages of it. And after you've heard from Hannah, you're going to hear from Mims Davis, who's the Minister for Employment and has been doing that since July 2019. Everyone is now back in the office. The ministerial team is ready to roll.
Here.
Very good. Right, good. Glad to hear it. And then from Tony Wilson, who's the Director of the Institute for Employment Studies. And if you're not already following him on Twitter and all the rest, you should be, because he has lots of excellent food for thought on what on earth is going on with the labour market. And then you're going to hear from Emma Stewart, who is the co-founder and development director at Timewise, which again, if you're not already following what they do lots of great work day in, day out with companies on how they can improve their working practice, particularly around flexible working. And as Hannah's going to show you, that is one of the big features of what we are seeing in the labour market today. And then, as always, you can get involved on Slido. We'll have a few polls there as we go through the morning, and you can ask questions of the panel via Slido, or if you're here in person, you get a prize, and you can ask questions with an actual microphone and your words, not typing, which is pretty exciting. So that is the plan, and to kick us off, over to you, Hannah.
Cool, thank you. So firstly, just to say a big thanks to both the Health Foundation and the Nuffield Foundation for supporting this work, and also to my co-authors, Mike and Charlie. This has been a big report. There's lots in it. You should definitely read the whole thing because there's loads I won't be able to cover today. We're here to talk about the labour market, and as Torsten said, it's not just kind of what's happening now, but what's going to happen in the future. So we all know that this pandemic has not been a normal labour market crisis. Not only have we had big changes to the way that we work in terms of both kind of the jobs that people are doing, the different sectors people are in, and remote working, but we've also had unprecedented policy intervention in the form of the job retention scheme. So as part of the Economy 2030 inquiry, which looks at kind of economic change and prospects over the next decade, we're going to be looking at how this is different from previous crises and what impacts could last beyond COVID, as best we can tell at this stage. So one of the impacts that people were really worried about earlier on in the crisis was high unemployment. And you can see from this chart that the unemployment rate has, in previous crises, seen big rises, particularly in the 80s and 90s, and to a lesser extent during the financial crisis. But if you look over at the very right-hand side of that chart, you can see that so far in the crisis, we haven't seen a big rise in unemployment. We saw a small uptick, particularly last winter, but it's starting to fall again. And if you look at the red line, the Office of Budget Responsibility is expecting only a small rise in unemployment at the end of this year, and then for it to decline over the next few years. And that's not only a smaller rise than we saw in other recessions, but also smaller, far smaller than they were expecting even in March this year. So it's kind of thanks to the kind of the reopening the economy kind of vaccinations, the prospects are looking really good, but it's also thanks to the intervention of the job retention scheme, which protected millions of workers' jobs and meant that we could have seen massive rises in unemployment, and instead people stayed connected to their jobs. But even though we haven't seen a rise in unemployment, we have seen some other changes in the size of the workforce. So I'm going to talk through this now. Broadly, we've seen the workforce get smaller, we've seen it get younger, and we've seen it get more female. So firstly, looking at the overall size of the workforce. So this chart is showing you the fall in labour force participation. So that's people who are either in employment or actively looking for a job since the start of the most recent economic crises. So the kind of yellowish gold line is the COVID-19 crisis. And you can see that in the first year or so of the pandemic, we saw big falls in participation that were kind of stronger than any other of these crises at similar points. And although that's now kind of started to level off, it still remains lower than both the financial crisis and the 1980s crisis at similar points. And what you can't see from this chart is that employment has started to rise. People are either kind of, well, people are getting back into work as more sectors of the economy open up, but we've still got lots of people who aren't, who have left the workforce entirely and who aren't yet returning. And the concern, of course, is that they won't return. So looking a bit more into kind of who these people are that are they're leaving the workforce, we see big age patterns in participation. So from this chart, the COVID-19 crisis is on the left, financial crisis on the right, and you can see that both the youngest and oldest age groups have seen falls in participation. We're actually less worried about the younger people because it's partly due to people spending more time in education during the crisis to kind of ride out the storm, and it's also similar to what we saw in the last recession. So it might be kind of more temporary, something to keep an eye on, but it doesn't seem to be kind of the big lasting legacy that we should be concerned about. Instead, we've seen big falls in participation among older workers and particularly among this 55 to 64 age group. So people leaving the workforce, and it's worth looking at a chart in the full report which shows a breakdown of this of workers in their 50s by gender. And we see that while men and women in that age group have seen relatively similar falls in employment, women are actually doing much worse than they were doing in previous crises. So in the last few recessions, women's employment has been relatively protected, but in this crisis, they've seen employment falls that are similar to those of older men among that age group. But turning to younger workers and the participation there, we see another kind of gender gap. So this is showing you kind of by age for men on the left and women on the right, the changes in participation in the workforce since 2019. And you can see that while among younger men, participation has been falling since the crisis, among lots of this age range among women, it's actually risen. And again, if you look at the full report, it digs into a bit more about kind of who these women are, and we focus particularly on parents, and we find that it's particularly among mothers, and particularly among mothers of young children. So mothers of under fours, for example, have seen around a 5 percentage point rise in their participation over the last 2 years. So it's kind of lots of women newly entering the workforce. And why might that be? We look at three reasons in the report. So one of them is not shown on this chart, but I'll just talk about it. It's kind of the sectors that have grown in relative terms since the crisis are those that are particularly female heavy relative to other sectors. So particularly kind of more office jobs. That's kind of provided opportunities for women to enter the workforce, for example, if that's where they've had previous experience earlier on in their careers and they're re-entering the workforce. But this chart shows two other reasons. So firstly, we've seen obviously a big rise in remote work during the crisis, which I'll come on to talk about in a second. But we asked people in a new survey that we ran with YouGov, a survey of working age adults that asked people about changes to their working lives since the pandemic. And we asked people if remote working had enabled them to enter the workforce or to increase their working hours. And if you look at the blue and turquoise bars, that's showing the share of people who said that that was the case. And you can see that particularly among mothers, this focuses only on people in couples, but among mothers in this group, about 1 in 10 said that they'd been able to enter the workforce thanks to remote working, or that they'd been able to increase their working hours thanks to remote working. And that's about twice the rate of fathers and twice the rate of women without children as well. So it is worth saying that, Catherine Mann on the Monetary Policy Committee was talking about this last week, that if women are more likely to work remotely after the pandemic, and if employers essentially favour people who are in the office, that could have detrimental impacts on women's career paths. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on. But by and large, that kind of seems to be one of the drivers that's helping people get into the workforce. And the third reason that we consider for more women in particular entering the workforce is something that happened after the financial crisis, which is basically that people who had income shocks in the household, those that were not already working or were working part-time, increased their labour supply, so worked more to make up for that income shock. And we find some evidence that people are doing that. So the red bars here show you that, particularly, again, slightly more among mothers, although among all the groups we look at here, between a fifth and a quarter of people in couples are saying that they have increased their labour supply in some way, and also that their partner has taken an income hit. So that seems to be driving it as well. So kind of been focusing a lot on who is in work and kind of how much work is being done. But just to touch on two other lasting changes in the crisis that could provide lessons for the future. So firstly, thinking about sectoral reallocation, we know that there's been a lot of kind of changes in the relative sizes of different sectors. Sectors like hospitality and leisure have shrunk given all the restrictions on them, whereas other sectors like healthcare and kind of other public sector jobs in particular have grown. But we find in the report that this hasn't actually been happening through people doing more kind of moving between jobs. So this chart is showing you the share of job-to-job moves that's happening to a different sector or to the same sector, and actually moves to a different sector have kind of fallen in relative terms very slightly since the start of the pandemic. And also this is kind of against a backdrop of lower job-to-job moves in general. And this holds true even when we look at just kind of people who are in a different industry than a year earlier, so kind of allowing them to take some time out of work in between. There doesn't seem to have been a big rise in people just switching sectors, moving from one job to the next. So instead, it seems to be about people leaving shrinking sectors like hospitality and leisure, and different people entering the workforce into growing sectors. And that's one kind of thing that we should be thinking about, though, when we're thinking about reallocation, is workers being overqualified for their job. So this chart is showing you that since the start of the pandemic, there's been a rise in the share of people who are overeducated for their current occupation relative to other people in that occupation. And so that might be partly compositional. We've had a few more young people getting more qualifications, and older people leaving the workforce who tend to have lower levels of qualification. But it could also reflect people not being in the kind of suitable jobs for their skill set, which is something we should keep an eye on. And finally, remote work. So the patterns that you can see on the left-hand side about kind of who's remote working at the moment won't be a surprise to anyone. It's higher paid workers and less so lower paid workers. But if you look at the right-hand side about what people expect in a year's time since they were surveyed, people expect remote and hybrid working in particular to outlast the pandemic, but also again it's higher paid workers who don't necessarily expect to be spending lots of their time working entirely from home, but they expect to be doing a lot more hybrid working than they were in the past. But we shouldn't forget that this hybrid work has implications for lower earners as well. So we've got kind of while high paid workers are doing more remote working, the jobs that low paid workers are doing are as a result shifting. So people aren't going to the cafes and whatever near their offices anymore. They're shopping more locally around where they live. So that means the changes in kind of demand and lower paid service jobs in particular. So just to wrap up, this crisis has been unique, but the labour market legacy at Leeds will be equally unique. So lasting impacts as far as we can tell now, and obviously things are still in flux, but it seems to be that there's going to be higher inactivity rather than unemployment. That we've seen big sectoral changes, but that's been via entry and exit into the workforce, and that might have left us with some skills mismatch. And we're set to see, at least as far as workers' expectations are concerned, a longer-term shift to hybrid working with all the kind of geographical implications that has. And these are things we'll be looking more into in future reports as part of the Economy 2030 inquiry. But kind of for now, I'll just leave you with this this point, which is that policy needs to focus on the legacy that the pandemic has left us with, that these things I've mentioned, not the kind of things we were concerned about earlier on in the crisis, like higher unemployment.
Great.
I'll stop there.
Thank you very much indeed, Hannah. That is a lot of material very clearly set out, so thank you very much indeed for that.
Over to you, Minister.
Yeah, I'm going to grab the lectern, okay. If it's okay. I've just realised that water and juggling reg folders and everything might be a little bit dodgy.
And we want smooth speeches on the back of it.
Okay, we're going for smooth. Okay, good morning, everybody, and lovely to see you all and everyone online listening. I hear this is very popular, so please don't turn off now. Can I start by thanking the Resolution Foundation for all your work. What an interesting and timely report. And thank you so much for inviting me to hear about it and discuss it today. The impact on the labour market, both positive and negative, let's be honest, about the tiers, lockdowns, hybrid working, the COVID economy, the impact on labour market needs. So much has gone on in the last 18 months. But I'd like to pick up 2 points pretty much in particular, and I think it's really striking from the research that 10% more mothers were importantly able to enter the workforce and increase their hours. And blooming well done, ladies, because we're all juggling homeschool and other things going on as well, and well done employers for supporting that as well and understanding the ability around flexibility for that. There's a particular time that I remember my youngest daughter, we had to have a discussion about her pre-planning printing because I was in the middle of responding to a select committee and she ran in, "I have to print now!" And there was about 79 pages of the Egyptians coming out in about 3 lots. All chuntering away, printing in the background. But that's what we're all doing, and let's be honest about it, and fantastic that we could all do that. So we need to maintain and build on this flexibility of working, that blended approach, that understanding that we've managed to achieve in this, you know, almost post-pandemic world as we're working for, so that a job can fit around anybody's personal experiences, and things change in your working life, your personal life, etc. So we need to be able to make sure that employment works positively for people. And I think it's brilliant, looking at the report, Hannah, that presenteeism has basically been busted through. Absolutely brilliant. We've been trying to do that for some time, particularly for mothers through that remote and hybrid working, that balance. The difficulty, though, is not creating a living at work issue. And sometimes it's felt like that for me. And we need to look at the impacts. And of course, if you're higher paid and everything's really pleasant and you've got a wonderful garden room to work in, how brilliant. But if you are in shared accommodation, you haven't got privacy, you're working on an ironing board, you know, it's not the quite the same experience. So I'm really pleased to see that the report underlines the change and the unprecedented nature of what we've seen in terms of what the UK is facing. And it's different questions, as Hannah concluded with. And above all, we are not dealing with that feared mass unemployment that we, you know, really worried about at the start of the pandemic. Now, I'd like to use some of the time just to pick up on why we're in this point and what the government's done in terms of interventions to the labour market. And I think we're in a place of real optimism of what we can build on from this, rather than goodness gracious how it could have been. And in fact, our biggest problem, my biggest headache right now, is what we're going to do with vacancies. We've got 1.2 million vacancies out there. And so we recognise that the pandemic was unprecedented. I think that's the word of the year. I think it's the word of last year. I think it's the word of this year. And that's why we put in £400 billion to support people to stay in work, but also to stay in their homes and keep their livelihoods and lives together. And we showed that as a government, we were unafraid to help people in the most difficult times. And thank goodness we did, because it has really worked. And who knew the word furlough coming into this? Clearly only the Chancellor. And of course, the self-employed income support. And I, as a constituency MP, and I think you talk to any constituency MP, and I recently had a bounce back business breakfast with some of my great local businesses. But the consistent message is thank you for saving me, my business, my job, my work, my livelihood, but also all the people I work with and all the people that I connect with and all the supply chains that I'm in. So let's not underestimate that in any way, because people couldn't work, they couldn't be in their sector, and it's absolutely no fault of their own. Now, social distancing measures have generally been lifted, but they're not really, are they? We've still got a challenge here as we go through winter with the NHS pressures and how we balance, you know, getting back to work and continuing to progress positively, but also, you know, recognising that COVID is still a challenge in the workplace. So we continue to support people, whether it's through welfare or whether it's through our interventions in employment programmes, but very much of the backdrop of still quite challenging times. And what I'm most proud of is how we've invested in our young people, those people who have been most at risk of long-term unemployment, those people who have been in those bedrooms waiting and hoping for the world to open up without that graduation, without that leaving of school or college, and have been really worried about the future. And we're told you should be worried about your future. And we've done something about changing people's lives who were very concerned about that. And I'm very proud of the £2 billion that we've put into the Kickstart scheme. It's caused a lot of grey hairs and a lot of stress in DWP, but it's been absolutely worth it. And thank you so much to all the employers and the sectors who have stepped forward to give our young people the opportunity. And just last week, alongside our most recent positive job figures, we saw just over 100,000 young people getting that life-changing first start on the employment ladder. And that's phenomenal with the tiers and the lockdowns and the changes that we've been able to facilitate. And what is Kickstart? It's a 6-month placement for all different kinds of jobs and sectors, from chocolate factories to working with llamas to working in tech or digital, or you name it, historic houses. It's been incredible. Incredible where these opportunities have come from. And in fact, many of the jobs that have been most popular have been in eco or sustainability, in areas where young people really want to get that first opportunity. And we've extended it. We've got more young people coming in over the next few months. And again, I'm very proud of the work we've done across DWP, whether it's, you know, how UC have supported people, how our job centres have stayed open for the most vulnerable. But we've also been opening youth hubs in every single Job Centre Plus district across England, Scotland and Wales by Christmas. And we're already there. So 150 new youth hubs are open. These are embedded in local communities. They are working with local councils, football clubs, rugby clubs, charities like the Prince's Trust or the local colleges and local training providers. And it's been a personal mission of mine to boost DWP's youth offer, and that's how we do it. So if you've got housing issues, mental health worries, family worries, training or learning worries, there's somewhere for you to go. And very often it's where do you start if you are worried about the next stage. And I also just want to recognise the immense value that our older workers have played in the workforce. And of course, as we've seen of how people have had to pivot and change because of COVID. And we need to recognise people of all ages have been able to do that in the workforce. But actually, those people who never expected their sector to, you know, come away at the seams, if you look at aviation or tourism or other areas, you know, people who've worked very hard to be in those sectors never expected to be trying to find way to transition those skills into other parts of the economy. So we've got a new refreshed 50 plus champion network. Now this means dedicated support to those people via work coaches, the double the number that we've brought through in 37 job centre districts, to effectively support people through our wider plan for jobs to help directly those 50 plus claimants. Because if you fall out of the labour market at that point, if you're balancing caring or health issues, and then actually you fall out of the labour, it's so much harder to come back in. And of course, then your retirement and everything else can be affected by that. So we're doing a midlife MOT, not far away from that myself, on health and work and wellbeing. And of course, we've all the different interventions that we've had, from job finding support to JETS. And in fact, job finding support has helped 160,000 job seekers. We've got the Flexible Support Fund, which has helped people to transition and train, get extra help through their work coaches. And JETS has been our most brilliant intervention. What on earth is she talking about? JETS is 6 months intervention, where it really starts to bite that unemployment, that challenge, and your CV's not going anywhere. And we've found that's really been our most successful intervention. Of course, we've got Restart as well. And so we're working across the vacancy needs as well with our sector-based work academies. That's where we can upskill or add on skill or transition people to help people move into those sectors of need. We've got it in rail, digital, in HGVs, in hospitality, you name it. And there's a guaranteed job interview at the end of it, and you get all the skills and the learning that you need. So in conclusion, I think we've been bold with our policy. We've obviously more to learn. And in fact, it's quite amazing to think the challenge right now is vacancies rather than unemployment. In fact, unemployment has fallen for the last 9 months in a row. It's now at 4.3%, and we are set to be the highest growth in terms of the G7 in this next year. So my message to anyone listening or engaging is to, you know, look at what's out there. There is an opportunity for any age or stage of your career. Don't rule yourself out, rule yourself in, because employers are ruling people in a way that they haven't done before, whether it's through tech, whether it's the fact that people with disablement are getting more opportunities, the fact that we've busted through presenteeism. And we've got an extra 13,500 work coaches and more job centres. And if you haven't been to one for some time or looked at our job help website, it's transformed. So go grab that help and we'll help you progress on the next stage. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much, Mims. That's a lot of policy action, but it has been a busy 2 years.
Tell me about it.
Right, Tony, what's going on?
Well, what is going on? Brilliant, thank you. Thanks, Torsten, for having me. And I'm going to just add my thanks to Hannah and the team for this paper, which I think is excellent. It's a really excellent read, and I think it really reiterates and draws out how we've averted this the unemployment crisis that we all thought we were going to have, but we're now in the grip of a crisis of participation, which is deeper and I'd argue is going to be more long-lasting and more enduring than what we've seen, certainly in the most recent recession, as that graph showed at the start, most likely anytime going back to the early 1990s. Now, I think that participation gap, that crisis, is even bigger if you take account of the decades-long growth that we were seeing in the labour market from the 1990s through thick and thin up until now. If you allow for that, we're probably talking about, we think, about a million fewer people in the labour market than what we would have expected on pre-crisis trends, and about half of that missing million being older people, as Hannah's set out. This is, I think, the single biggest labour market impact we're seeing of the crisis is falling participation for older people. And about one-fifth is young people, students in particular, which I will come back to in a minute. And I think this report's right to emphasise economic inactivity as a key driver of this. But I would add, when we look underneath that, my biggest concern here is that we're going in the wrong direction. We may be going in the wrong direction on some of the measures of economic inactivity. So just looking over the last year, from post lockdowns, July to September last year, to the same time this year, economic inactivity has been broadly flat, risen a little bit. But underneath that, we've seen economic inactivity due to ill health rise by 100,000. We've now got the highest levels of long-term ill health since the mid-2000s. And we're seeing economic inactivity due to short-term ill health has risen by 30% over the last year. And at the same time, inactivity for other reasons, COVID-related reasons probably, is by COVID-related, I don't mean having COVID, which I think is partly explaining the short-term point, but absence due to work shutting down. Economic inactivity for other reasons has fallen by about 100,000. So this participation crisis is also one, I think, of higher worklessness due to poor health. And in turn, this is holding back the recovery. And I think this is, we haven't talked about it here, but clearly policymakers at the bank are now grappling with what we do about controlling inflation. I'm not sure wages, and Resolution Foundation made this point last week in the labour market data. The wages data is not, wages are not growing as fast as some people are saying. So we're not quite seeing this kind of wage price spiral, if you like, or mild, potential mild wage price spiral that, that some have anticipated. But we will start to see this feed through into data, likely higher wages. We're already in a period of higher inflation, and if the response is to raise interest rates, which I think it will need to be, and potentially on a higher path than some are expecting, then that in turn will hold back the recovery, potentially, certainly will hold back the jobs recovery. And I think one graph in that presentation was really, really interesting at the start, showing the bank, the OBR's forecast for unemployment. You know, these have been consistently, understandably, consistently pessimistic, and you know we've ended up over. Unemployment has fallen by more. It's falling by more already. You know, I suspect it's unlikely to rise significantly, if at all, as furlough ends. But the consequence is we're probably being optimistic about how much slack there is in the labour market and how much slack will be created through a job retention scheme. So that story of really high vacancies. And vacancies, this isn't just in low-paying work. Vacancies are higher than pre-crisis levels in every single industry than they were before COVID. That story of higher vacancies, lower unemployment is going to persist. And we're now at a point where there's fewer unemployed people per vacancy than at any point in at least 50 years. So on that sort of classic sort of measure of the tightness or slackness of the labour market, you know, we're facing unprecedented tightness, you know, we think, in the labour market. So look, if that's the bad news, if you like, or that's the challenge, you know, what's the good? I would just reiterate this point. You know, the plan for jobs has worked, and the government deserves, you know, great credit for what it's done on protecting jobs. But I'd argue also this shows that good public policy works. And you know, if it can, I'll take one example that isn't often talked about: is long-term unemployment for young people. Long-term unemployment for young people, we take as an almost inevitable consequence of recessions. And we're barely a year on from the COVID crisis. Long-term unemployment for young people is dropping fast, and it's virtually at pre-crisis levels. And that is a consequence, partly it's the economy, but in large part it's because, you know, we all focused on addressing it, whether that was national government, local government, whether that was people in delivering volunteering community services, employment services, charities, everybody was focused on this issue. Let's apply that same focus to raising participation, particularly for disadvantaged groups, particularly for people with health conditions. So three things in terms of what we do, my last minute, and I was really determined to talk about what we do about it. The first is, we've had a plan for jobs, we need a plan for participation. I think that particularly means around work and health. Three things: you know, we need to boost our investment and our focus on occupational health services to keep people in work and support people back to work. We need then to improve access to, we need to improve how health and employment services work together, particularly locally. And thirdly, we need to massively invest in specialist disability and health-related employment services. We spent more on the furlough scheme, even in the last month of the furlough scheme, we spent more on the furlough scheme in a single week than we do on disability employment services in a year. You know, we can and we must do better on this. And if you're disabled, you're twice as likely to be out of work as if you're not. And I think, you know, we must do better and we can do better. Secondly, I think we need a plan for our public employment services, not just Job Centre Plus. I would include in that restart. This is the biggest investment we've made in contracted out services ever. And our public employment services are bigger than they were. They were set up for a mass unemployment crisis. Now we can face them at addressing the reallocation challenges that Hannah set out and those vacancy problems for employers. And this means I think we need to move away from a claimant conditionality service, which focuses only on helping those who claim the right bit of benefit, towards one where anyone who wants a job, on benefit or not, whether you're a student, a pensioner, where, you know, whatever your circumstances, can go to get the help they need to find a job, and where employers can go to fill those vacancies. A word on students here, let's not lose sight of students as a potential pool of untapped labour. If we got back to the employment rate for full-time students we had in the 2000s, now there'd be 400,000 more people in work. So we can do, you know, students are a potential untapped pool here. Where do you go if you want a job if you're a student? Well, you don't go to Job Centre Plus, unfortunately. Final point is employers, and at this point I think it's as well that I stop. There's a huge amount we can do around better supporting employers, but Emma, I think, is really well placed to talk about this, and to talk about the things we can do to improve flexibility, security and opportunities in particular, and work better with firms to do that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Tony. Impressive combination of shed loads of food for thought and a very smooth segue to Emma. So, Emma,
thank
over to you.
Thank you, Dawson. Thanks for having me, and absolutely fascinating and a very complex report. So I just want to really focus on a few observations around how the way we are changing how we work is affecting businesses in particular, but also affecting job seekers and people in work. I've got three main observations. The first, starting with a positive, is we do agree that we think hybrid is here to stay, and that is a good thing. That is a huge opportunity to increase labour market participation for people who need more autonomy and control in how, when, and where they work in terms of flexibility. But we also just need to not be complacent. We need to keep reinstating the benefits of hybrid working to businesses. There are huge benefits to individuals, but you know, we are seeing through our work at Timewise, we work with hundreds of employers, helping them improve flexible working, have done for years. We're seeing some wobbles. It's complex. Redesigning work in teams, in different industries, at scale like this is complex. And we've got to make sure we don't drift back into the way things were, because otherwise we are going to risk people who have been able to access work actually falling out. So that's my first point. Secondly, I just want to comment on the fact that not everybody is seeing equal benefits from the way we've changed the way we work. So a couple of thoughts. One on gender. I'm really pleased to see the participation of women, younger women, particularly mothers, increasing. I think we have to be a little bit careful about how sustainable that is. Obviously, some of the drivers are around balancing out from loss in wages in the family. But we also, and also it has improved their ability to balance work and childcare. If you are working remotely, you don't necessarily have to work part-time. But we still have a problem with quality part-time jobs in this country, and we've all discussed this for many, many years. And if we want to encourage more of those people who are economically inactive, who have health issues, who have caring responsibilities, who are older, back into the workplace, we've got to also think about how we keep redesigning part-time jobs. The transition we've had over this last 18 months has very much been around location-based flexibility. We need a focus on time-based flexibility as well. And that also is a concern in terms of thinking about how we make sure that if women are working more remotely and they are participating, they're not excluded from opportunities. So we are concerned, and we are starting to see anecdotal feedback. And again, it was drawn out in the report. That being remote means being overlooked. We are seeing proximity bias in the workplace. It is a real thing. And we need to make sure that more firms don't just do hybrid working, but they make sure they have an inclusive approach to that. The second sort of risk I want to call out is around sectors. Winners, clearly, in terms of people working in this new way of working now, are, as the report called out, office workers, mainly in London, mainly in high wages. Losers, we've all discussed, are those in frontline for whom there has been very little adjustment in how they work. There are still trade-offs around flex and security. There are still significant issues. If you're working in retail and hospitality, you need predictability. Predictability in your flexibility. You need to know when you're working, you need advance notice. And these are sectors that haven't necessarily had the ability to adapt. We have huge skill shortages in them, and therefore we need a renewed focus around, as well as sector-based academies, also thinking about how we support employers in particular sectors to build management capability to enable them to try different ways of working flexibly. And then my final point, just briefly, is on the vacancy side of things. So we have millions and millions of vacancies in the market. We have a concern at Timewise, and we have been tracking the vacancy market for many years to see which employers specify flex from day one at the point of hire. So if we have millions of people who need flexibility, they need to see that that's on offer in a job ad. And yet this year, we still only have 26% of job vacancies referencing flexibility in a job ad. That means 3 out of 4 job vacancies don't say anything about it. We need to encourage more employers, if they're open to this, to say so, because otherwise people who want that will not apply, because there is still a risk that you can't transfer the flexibility having one job into another job. If we want to encourage people to move around different sectors, many of the sectors where we've seen jobs lost are flexible sectors, sectors where people work part-time. So we need more businesses to do this. Only 1 in 10 job vacancies still references part-time. Only 3% of job vacancies references anything about flexibility on shifts. We have 7 million frontline workers. And only, shockingly, 8% actually reference hybrid working. So we need to really focus on making sure that we are talking to businesses and we're encouraging businesses. The legislation from day one, consultation, is very welcome, but that will take time to come through. We need to be having these conversations now. Otherwise, people who are looking at those vacancies will not necessarily feel they're able to apply.
Great. Thank you very much, Emma. Right. As you can tell, we're covering a lot of issues here. So and we've got loads of great questions coming in as well. So I think what we should, to try to do justice to the range of issues, let's try and take this in 4 sections. So first of all, and relatively briefly, like, what is going on? Unemployment. It's a triumph. How on earth did that happen? In brackets, is it a triumph for everybody? Secondly, there's an activity question, which we've, this half of the panel has like dwelt on for most of this discussion, but is like the big surprise in some ways compared to what people were expecting. Let's really briefly touch on sectoral change, which we haven't really brought out much in this conversation. Whereas if you step back and look at what's unusual about this crisis, it is the variation for sectors, which is just totally unlike anything we've ever seen in a crisis before, maybe outside wars where you kind of start owning big chunks of sectors. And then let's do work from home. Which is obviously, and Emma's brought out a lot of the kind of difficult bits. We've had like the easy bits of the work from home revolution, and we're now getting into the like difficult bits of like, how do we actually work out what we are doing? Now, to kick us off, we're going to put our first live poll up on Slido. Now, the hashtag on Slido, if you haven't already got it, is labour market, I think. Yes, hashtag labour market. Right, so the first question, and we're not going to do the results here because we'll come to this bit of the conversation in a second, but you can hopefully all see that. So what will happen to labour market participation amongst older people? So we're just here focusing on the fall amongst the older workers that we've seen. We normally see a fall amongst older men, and we've managed to get a fall amongst older men and older women this time. That's what's unusual. The question is, how much of that will last? Okay, now we've got some slightly facetious titles for these options. So is it Great Retirement, which is basically, this is lasting. We're going to stay with a lower level of older people working. Is it a boom, as in they're all going to go straight back as soon as COVID cases are hopefully under control come the spring? Is it just a pause, which is for this cohort of older workers, the ones that happen to be in your late 50s when the crisis came along, they're going to stay out of the labour market. But when the next load of late 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds come through, they'll get back to the very high rates of participation we were seeing pre-crisis. So is it permanent? Is it temporary? Or is it going to be really temporary and we don't need to worry about this at all? So basically, how worried are you is the question, okay? So have a vote on Slido while we are starting to go through some of these questions. Now, let's do unemployment first because it's the simple bit. And we didn't cover, I think there's a slight danger that we forget how different what has actually happened is compared to what we expected. So we should like take a step back. Because the first chapter of the report is actually digging into a load of survey data specifically on what happened to people who were on furlough at the end of the scheme, at the end of October, and what happened to them as we moved into October when the scheme ended. And Hannah, do you want to just give people the headlines of what that survey said numbers-wise?
Sure. So we found that, so this was also published in a kind of separate spotlight the other week, so you should also read that as well as the whole report. But we found that the vast majority of furloughed workers who were furloughed in September at the end of the scheme, went back into their previous jobs. So about 9 in 10 went back to their previous jobs. Even of this kind of 1.1 million who were furloughed right up until the end. So while we were really worried, when we were thinking about this over the summer and in early September about people who were basically left on furlough and were going to lose their job straight away when the scheme ended, that doesn't seem to have been the case. And some people have suggested that could be, you know, we should still keep an eye on that. People might just be kind of working out redundancy periods. But broadly, we haven't seen job losses even in the kind of official payroll data that we got last week from the ONS. But we also have seen in our survey that we included in this report, we've seen that quite a lot of people who were furloughed during the crisis, and particularly people who were furloughed for long periods of time, are worried about losing their jobs. So it's kind of not, you know, we shouldn't be complacent about it, but we should be maybe cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, basically extending the furlough scheme until we'd reopen the economy was the right thing to do. And that is in the end, it's not really about whether our forecasts were wrong, because they were wrong and the actual numbers from the ABR, everyone's forecasts were wrong. But fundamentally, the actual policy regime changed drastically during the course of the crisis as well. And that in the end is the main driver. It's not the only driver, but it's the main driver. Now, Tony, why don't you take this one from Jacob, which is about different groups. So overall, unemployment's been a triumph in terms of how quickly it's come back down. But if we step back and look at what we saw during the crisis, some groups saw a hugely disproportionately rise in unemployment temporarily. Some of those fell back really quickly. Young people stand out on that metric. But on some ethnic minority groups who did see very much larger falls in labour market activity and unemployment during the crisis, rise in unemployment during the crisis, we've seen slightly less speedy recoveries.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely right. And it's a really important point when we look in particular at employment gaps. We can look at both unemployment and employment. If we look at the gaps in employment rates between disadvantaged groups and people who don't have that disadvantage, those had been narrowing in the run-up to the crisis for the most part. as the economy had been relatively strong, as the labour market had been tightening. And they've either stopped narrowing or in some cases widened during the crisis. And ethnic minority employment is a really good example of that, where there's been a long run narrowing of that gap. It's now flat, and for some groups it appears to be rising. Now, it's worth saying, there's a point there I think said inactivity is low. Actually, inactivity is higher for ethnic minority groups than for white people. And so part of the reason why you get, it's a very, very techie point, but part of the reason why we often get these very large rises in unemployment is because the labour pool overall is smaller, and unemployment is calculated by dividing the number of unemployed by the number of employed plus unemployed. So for the same fall in employment, you can see larger rises in unemployment. But actually, we're seeing falls in employment which are larger too for ethnic minority groups. And we published a paper on this called An Unequal Crisis for Youth Futures Foundation and Blagrove Trust about 6 months ago, which showed bigger falls for young black people and young Asian people than for young white people. And that's really worrying. I think at the moment that's kind of occupational factors. It's the jobs that people do, but I think it's a real risk that leads to permanent scars and reverses the progress we've seen.
Great, thank you, Tony. Right, let's move on to inactivity. So there's lots of questions on this big inactivity question that's coming through. I'm going to bring up a few of them here. You've got a question from one of your opposite numbers, Jonathan Reynolds, MP. I'm glad all political parties are watching Resolution Foundation events, it turns out, which basically says, why is inactivity going up rather than unemployment? Well, obviously, the report has all the answers on that. But we should come, touch on that as we go through. But let's also touch on David's question, which is for you, Mims, which is basically saying, look, so there's this big, everyone everywhere is discussing high vacancies and fewer workers around. Okay, most of the public discussion is around migration. It's about saying we've got fewer migrants, that's why you can't get an HVG visa driver, basically. What this report is slightly encouraging us to do is to not just focus on the migration question, but to focus on the actual workers who are actually here right now, and a fewer of them are working. So what do we think in terms of where labour force growth will come from in future? So the answer pre-crisis was women and older people and migrants. Those are the three groups that saw big growth in labour force participation, and actually ethnic minorities, going back to the previous question, and some parts of the country, in brackets, the places with low unemployment. But where is it going to come from in future, do you think?
So I don't think it's a question of thinking about where it's going to come from. I think it's about making sure the people with the barriers who aren't progressing, who are being held back, who are sitting there and being overlooked potentially, actually see progression. So to Tony's point, if you're a young black guy, the opportunity is never better for you to get into the labour market and progress. And if that doesn't happen this time, something is going wrong. So let's just turn the dial on these areas. So the barriers that I had to deal with as employment minister when I was appointed haven't changed. We've been through all of this. The people that are left behind are still the same groups. And as we heard, from Emma, it's making sure that, you know, disability is not holding you back from progressing and being part of the labour market. Now, there's some weird anomalies here, we know. So the settlement scheme, we've got, 6 million people part of the settlement scheme, we're expecting 3 million. Yeah. So, you know, where there's been some distortion
turns
in there
out our
somehow.
Migration data is rubbish.
Well, I wouldn't, I'll let you point that out.
You can
out,
choose but, a more polite phrase, but it's basically
but
garbage.
The point right. is, if you continue to say, right, well, the answer is more migration, it's easy. There's no guarantee everyone's going to come because people have reassessed. They might want to be home with their families, doing things differently. So our answer is to do something about that inactivity data or that long-term unemployed if you're a young black male. For me, that's a big priority, making sure that these dials change on that stuck labour market. Just quickly on the inactivity point as well. You know, it might be some people sitting on redundancies or life changes or other things going on in their life. They're deciding, right, we're going to wait to see where the labour market goes to where I dive back in. Or they may have had health conditions or caring changes in their lives as well. So, you know, people are reassessing that. There's no doubt about that. And if there was a a time you're going to reassess. COVID is going to be the time. So what we've got to make sure is that we get older workers back in. So my answer is absolutely. The latter part of your career can be one of the most fulfilling, biggest choices and opportunities you can grab. You might not be balancing, you know, young children and, you know, other challenges that, you know, those sort of growing pains that you have in your, your career. And finally, I think, you know, we've got to do something better about women returners. We've got to have more good quality part-time roles. And if employers advertise flexible and inclusive roles, guess what? They're going to get people. For example, I've seen that with bus companies where they go, do you know what? We're not getting people filling the shifts that we've got. Well, hold on, let's look at the shifts. Why don't they work? Let's do some more split shifts. Let's do some more evening or weekend opportunities. Let's think, not ask people to come to us, let's go to them with an offer that they'll want to be part of.
Great. That's what all the bus companies should do, and everything in life should come back to the buses.
Here, here, buses, always.
Right, look, let's take a question from Mark Harrison from the Federation of Small Business, which is going to come up on the screen in a second, and then we're going to have the poll.
You know, when you're an MP too long, you just say here, here to everything.
Well, I'm going to say too long. Given that,
it's been six years.
Six years. Yeah, some of them will be going for 50.
I'll start saying that at the Christmas dinner table. Here, here.
Don't do that. Don't do that at Christmas dinner. it's not a Christmas tradition that everyone's after. Right, Mark Harrison. So why don't you guys take this, which is like, so look, this is getting at the same-ish question, but coming at it from the lens of the vacancies bit, which is, you know, the other half of this, which is they're really high. At one level, we should expect them to be high.
Yeah.
One, online vacancies in general have been drifting up over time because it's cheaper to advertise in the new economy. Two, we just reopened an economy after shutting it down for 2 years. And so unsurprisingly, we're getting like a flood of companies trying to think about what they're doing. But it has gone on quite a while.
Yeah.
The numbers have stayed quite high. That's good news for lots of people, as you say, more choice. The bus companies have to compete and offer them some proper shifts. That's good. But the companies, you know, you saw it at the CBI yesterday when they weren't talking about Peppa Pig. They were talking about how they couldn't hire the people they needed. So how long is it going to go on for?
Because some people are worried about coming back into the labour market. You mustn't forget that.
Yeah.
Their health and the well-being, whatever's going on, and the messaging, certainly for older workers, that's surely going to play a part, Tony.
Oh, I think it will, and I think there's a good stat in the report, which we've not tended to focus on much in our analysis, but I think we all need to dive into around it. People who are economically inactive and want to work, and we're actually seeing this big fall in the number of people who say that they want to work while being economically inactive, and that for me is a bit of a puzzle, and I think it's one we need to try and unpack a bit, because my expectation is that there's people who currently aren't looking but do want to go back. What the data's telling us is perhaps some people don't. Speaking to this point, that suggests that this fall in participation is, I mean, it is definitely a large part of what's driving it. These kind of problems of reallocation are clearly a massive part. And a lot of that, we shouldn't entirely discount migration as a factor. Partly that's Brexit, partly it's every country is having these problems.
There's a pandemic on.
It's hard for, everyone is competing for the same labour pool. How long will this go on over a million? I mean, well, it's going to be at least for the rest of this year, because the numbers are going up by, you know, month on month. They must start to level off soon, he says. But it will take a while for that to feed through into the data, and it could take a while for it to fall. But I would say even pre-crisis, 800,000 vacancies pre-crisis was an exceptionally high figure. And, you know, it's going to take a long time before it gets back to there. I would suggest we're going to see this for most of, I would expect for the, you know, at least the early part of next year, and it could persist for longer if we get, you know, keep getting a kind of strong recovery. The only caveat on that is I suspect, you know, we might start to see firms simply, you know, not creating those jobs and us having fewer low paid jobs. While there's clear benefits to that, if we can support that transition, there's risks too, because those are really important entry level jobs. They're the first step on the ladder for many people. We need to be careful what we wish for, I think, if we wish away, you know, low skilled, low paid work in the sorts of industries that people do progress from, although not in the sorts of numbers that we may have seen in the past.
Great. Now, let's bring up the results of the poll, because you've been voting, and then Emma can give us her view on what she would have said on the impossible to answer poll. So, which is very fair for Emma. Right, so what's going to happen? Are you pessimistic, optimistic, or medium? Come on, let's have the results.
Yeah.
It's a pause. 72% think that basically this cohort probably won't go back massively fast, but basically we'll get there because over time we'll get them. Emma, what do you reckon? I mean, to be honest, democracy's kind of spoken. Are you anti-democracy or are you pro-democracy?
I'm obviously pro.
Oh, right, good. That's reassuring.
But the concern is the time lag. I mean, the concern is the word slowly.
Yeah, you don't want to be the people paused.
I think we've got to talk about how do we keep people in jobs and stop them leaving, as well as how do we bring people back. Yeah. And, you know, we've talked a lot about this, and this was a problem pre the pandemic, which is obviously looking at the quality of the jobs that we're talking about, looking at people's input into those jobs, looking at how people have a voice. So I think there's a conversation, but it's a conversation we need to be having with businesses, and businesses are open to that conversation. The door is open more now than ever before. The talent crisis is significant, and businesses are doing all kinds of things to try and adjust. But as I said before, I think we've also got to recognise the cost to business in completely redesigning work and trying to make adjustments to enable people to be able to work differently and to be able to attract more people into some of these sectors that are really challenging. And we don't invest in this country in kind of job redesign. We don't invest in supporting managers to manage people in flexible shifts, split shifts. We see it in sectors from teaching to construction to social care. Don't get me started on social care. So I think we need to be really focused on how do we tackle both supply and demand side issues, and how do we enable businesses. We have things like Innovate UK, which is fantastic, R&D, tech, et cetera, et cetera. Where's the human capital side of things? Where's the investment in actually enabling businesses who haven't done this before to work out how to do it? So I think that's something we really need to have a conversation about as well.
Great. And I know you were all paying attention last Monday when we launched a report on British firms, but one of the things it highlights basically is that we are a catastrophe at management. And one aspect of that is we're not very good at designing jobs and thinking that through, basically. So, right, let's go on. Why are we seeing this fall in participation amongst older people? And by older, we should be really clear, we don't mean old. Loads of these older people are like 50, and when I'm 50, I'm definitely not planning to self-identify as old. So these older workers, so we bring up the question from Susan Murray from the David Hume Institute. She's saying, most of the conversation we've been having is about older workers mainly dropping out, possibly because of fear of the virus, which is totally rational given what it does to different parts of the population. But is it other things like more people taking on childcare? What do we reckon? People, what do you think?
I think there's always a balance here. You know, I've been that person who's been in work but not actually making any money because you're just, you know, keeping your head above water with the childcare. And that's, you know, hugely frustrating. And there's a huge bunch of women and families who are doing that. You know, we spend a huge amount of money on childcare as a country, but it's not working, and we know that. And it's something that the Prime Minister is very focused on. And Will Quince, who used to be of this parish, has gone over to have a look at that. And I know it's something that our new DfE Secretary of State is very interested in, and also our Secretary of State. We know, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that might be holding people back from progressing, and it's really difficult to, you know, stay in the labour market, juggling, you know, children and progressing at the same time. Quite often for women, is that just keeping your head above water and staying in the labour market? And what's been really interesting, we've been doing some work with our job centres, with some of our outreach on women returners, because actually there's a huge talent pool of people with incredible experience. And most recently did some conversations with some women in Bristol. You know, there's a woman who previously worked in, you know, mental health. She worked in a high security mental health area, and she wanted a quick route to come in and help with the mental health needs now that her children are grown up, and there's no clear route. So as we've heard from Emma, I think it's about rooting people back in and balancing and not using that time when your children are young just to coast. You know, how do we manage that, and how do we make it more affordable? There's lots in there. It's cross-government. We've got to get to grips with it. We know other countries do it different and better and all of those things. So, you know, let's really try and understand this, because we are living lives predicated generally on two people working in the family where you can. But what I am pleased about is that, for example, if you are a single parent on universal credit, you get more support with your childcare going into work. Through flexible support fund as well, you get additional help. So we are very mindful through the benefits process, and of course the changes to taper rate and the work allowance, all of that means that if you can get into work with a great employer and you've got children, we can support you.
And we get them. The new taper rate comes in tomorrow.
Yeah, very exciting.
And are you really restrained exciting. In not plugging that at all?
Well, I thought there was a moment for it to come up at some point, but it was that. It's a massive intervention, as Tony said, and we've talked about people who are stuck there. The barriers, you know, are too great for people, and it's the taper rate is a massive intervention.
Are you at all worried? So, like, the taper rate largely will improve working conditions, particularly, like you say, for people with children. And it's a lot of money for some families, particularly if you could be earning like on the, you know, in the 20s, thousands, and you've got kids, it could make a lot of difference to you. For older workers who are not working right now, if they're on universal credit, obviously they've seen the £20 a week fall, but they've not gained from the taper because they're choosing not to work, maybe because they're scared. Are you worried about what's happened to their incomes?
So generally, most people are going to be around £1,000 better off if they're working and using that taper rate. And, you know, what we need to do is give people the confidence to be going for those opportunities, either getting over the COVID hesitancy or the fact that, you know, they're just not sure how to transition. And that's why our JETS programme has been one of the most brilliant interventions, with over 40,000 people going into new jobs there, because actually we've helped them get over that transition, that challenge about where to go next. And I don't think you should underestimate, particularly for those older workers in more settled employment such as aviation or tourism or those areas who never expected to be looking for work. But if you're a pilot, it's darned difficult to find something that, you know, works for you. In fact, you know, one of my vaccine centres is run by a former pilot.
All right.
You know, so, you know, it's just finding how can you give those people that job satisfaction, use their skills, but also we need them to go back to some of those sectors as well going forward, because, you know, aviation in particular is a challenge.
And you hopefully don't get those we won't people be back. Vaccinating forever. So the,
Well, I think we'll have to continue to vaccinate on a rolling programme. But yeah, but quick, folks, get your boosters. Right now, it's really important.
Very good. Yeah, good public service announcement. Right, let's take a question from a genuine human in the room, at the front. Not that you're not genuine at home, just different.
Hiya, thanks very much. Great report. Just a question on the hybrid
work. Tell us your name, sir.
Sorry, my name is Patrick Flynn. On the hybrid working, so that might be allowing the one parent to come home and work from home and allowing the other parent to maybe go out and find a job. So that could actually be, you know, a social benefit of that, and, you know, more women working because of that. But there's also an aspect of it that it could be bringing down wages or suppressing wages, because I know a lot of employers are saying, well, if you want to work from home, I'm going to reduce your salary or something like that. Are we willing to, just your thoughts on, is that a success if we're getting upward mobility of more people kind of working, but we're seeing suppression of wages, okay, that kind of context?
I mean, that is a bold employer. That's the first thing I would say that's doing that right now when they're looking at the current vacancy rate. Why don't you take that, Emma?
We're not seeing a huge amount of wage suppression in the context of hybrid working. I think we're seeing it actually as a bolt-on on top of wage increases to encourage people to move into work. I think the thing about hybrid working, though, is it's really complex, and so absolutely it should be able to encourage dual-income households to be able to balance work and childcare more effectively. But one of the challenges with hybrid is you have to then work out the context of when you're in the office for your employer. And we're all working through a sort of crazy muddle at the moment where actually, you know, both couples may need to be in the office at the same time because their employer likes them in Tuesday, Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to take quite some time to sort of bottom out how this is going to work. And I also think the point about wage suppression and hybrid is the people that are falling through the cracks, as I said earlier, are people for whom hybrid actually isn't an option. So our nurses and our care workers and our retail workers who continually still...
Well, over half the population, we mean. Oh, yeah. Let's be absolutely blunt. We mean over half the population.
Yeah. Who are not part of the hybrid working conversation. The challenge for them, as I said earlier, is around predictability, input into shifts, autonomy, control. It's about how they have a mutual say in probably when they work. If they can't work, you know, change the location of work. It's about thinking about the times that they work and being able to have an opportunity. And you have to do that at a team-based level, so that in itself then also becomes quite complicated. So I think we have to be mindful of hybrid is complex. It's not necessarily a panacea. And there are definitely some flex haves and flex have-nots in that conversation that we need to call out.
Ooh, I've not heard flex haves and have-nots.
You see? Have
yeah, you know, you're branding it all. Right, okay, we're going to come back to the challenges of work from home in a second. But let's just talk then briefly on sectoral change. Okay, so first of all, let's do self-employment, which has been falling during the crisis. There's a question here from the audience on that. And then let's talk about sector change between kinds of jobs. So if we bring up the question, if we can, on the screen. Here we go, right. The ONS data says there's a large movement out of self-employment. What is going on? Hannah, what is going on?
Well, actually, less is going on than appears in the ONS data. So there's kind of two sides to the fall in self-employment. One is that, as lots of people have reported on throughout the crisis, including ourselves, self-employed people were harder hit by the economic impacts. They were more likely to kind of stop working, and they often didn't get support. They weren't eligible for the support that was provided. In lots of cases. But the other thing that we do look at in the report is kind of this shift from self-employment to being an employee. And there's definitely kind of good reasons why that might happen. This crisis is, it's kind of thrown into very sharp relief the kind of risks of self-employment and the instability, and you know that you often don't have the protection in kind of normal times of having an employer if your kind of demand is going up and down. But actually, it's a bit more complicated than that. So what actually seems to have happened is more of a reclassification of people in kind of in what they say they're doing. So when the ONS measures this data, they're basically just, well, not just, but they're basically asking people who answer the labour force survey, are you an employee or are you self-employed? And what the data suggests and what the ONS think as well is that people have kind of been changing how they think of themselves. So one tangible example of that would be people who are basically self-employed, but they pay themselves through PAYE for part or all of their kind of income. And they were able to furlough themselves during the pandemic, and that kind of changed the way that they think of themselves. They think, oh, actually, I kind of am an employee because I'm being paid through PAYE. And the data suggests that actually a lot of that has been happening, kind of people changing what they are saying each time they're surveyed as to what they're doing. But actually, when you kind of ask them, what are you doing now? What were you doing a year ago? They're saying, oh, I'm, you know, whatever I'm saying now, I'm saying I was doing the same thing a year ago. So it's a bit of a complex situation, but basically there has definitely been a hit to self-employment in terms of people moving out of work entirely. But in terms of moving over to employee jobs, there's not been so much of that happening. So
So we should trust the public when it comes to democracy, but not in terms of how they answer the Labour Force survey, which I think is basically a good lesson for all of us that spend their time on survey data. Right, that's one bit of, so don't get too excited about the big self-employment to employee shift is like one thing sectoral change wise. So Tony, on the other kind of sectoral change that's happening is just different parts of the economy. Some have shrunk, some have grown significantly. We're now back above employee numbers we had before crisis for the economy as a whole, but we're not there in terms of retail, hospitality and the rest, despite retail sales being up. One of the things in the report, and in general, that like there was a lot of chit chat about a year ago about how it was really important to get this reallocation of workers between sectors. Those that wanted, wrongly, to get rid of the furlough scheme this time last year were saying, we've got to get rid of this furlough scheme because we need people to move between sectors. And whereas what Hannah's report shows is, we've had this big change between sectors to some degree. It's not coming from people moving directly between sectors in the way that most economists talk. It's coming through this change on the margins around activity, unemployment and the rest.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, and it's a really good point in the report as well, an important insight. And I think it's worth saying we are still seeing large numbers of people moving sectors. So it's the lowest rate on that graph. It shows the proportion of all those moving, but the levels of people moving job to job are so high that we still got the highest level of job moves from one sector to another since kind of mid 2000s, I think. So we are still seeing people moving around quite a lot. There's also some good analysis in there, which I haven't entirely got my head around yet, which is looking at the sorts of skill levels of jobs that people move. So the ONS, the published ONS data tells us this. I mean, it tells us that a lot of people are moving out of and into low-skilled work and high-skilled work. But actually, it looks like that, well, as you'd expect, the turnover is greater in lower-skilled work. The one point I make, though, about sector change, some of these things are quite difficult. I mean, I was saying, one of the interesting, look at those occupation groups that have seen the most the most change. You know, yes, hospitality has been a huge one, but another one has been cleaning, for example. We've seen massive falls, nearly 200,000 fewer people working in cleaning. Most of those, most commonly, that's women working part-time. Now, the transition, if you like, from being a part-time office cleaner into another job is not going to be straightforward if you're not able to access kind of employment-related support you might need to get that. You may not necessarily need retraining, reskilling. You know, this is fundamentally, I think, about how our public employment services work and how they work better with our skills and training services too. But it needs to be both. I wouldn't lose sight, though, where we are seeing really significant growth in the labour market as well. We've seen phenomenal growth in some highly skilled jobs, particularly information technology. There's more than 200,000 more people working in information technology-related jobs than a year ago, and that does feel like a skill shortage rather than just a labour shortage. But we're also obviously seeing really significant growth in health-related services and things that are related to the pandemic. You know, so some of this is test and trace, and some of this is around home working and home deliveries and so on. But so, you know, time of enormous change, and I think, you know, coming back to my point earlier, and I do think the worry here is how well set up we are with a kind of more integrated employment and skills system to be able to provide that kind of, you know, those transition support services that people will need, regardless of what benefit you're on, regardless of what your circumstances are. And that's a big challenge for all of us, I think.
It's definitely a big challenge for all of us. Right, a bigger challenge is we've got 3.5 minutes to cover all of working from home. So here is the plan. First of all, I'm going to bring up a poll for you all to vote on again, if I can make this working on it. So it should come up now on your screens. Right, so we've done the good bit of, as Emma was saying earlier, we've done the good, easy bit of hybrid working when it comes to at least gender, which is, it's clearly a contributing factor. It's not the only one, but it's a contributing factor to the really quite large rise in maternal employment. But what will its long-term effect be? To increase the gender pay gap, basically what Emma's worried about, which is like presenteeism returns via the hybrid working model, decrease it because it's killed presenteeism and it's killed the cost of flexibility, basically. They might even make some men do some flexible working, who knows? Or some of you might be really, you know, kind of nihilists out there and think nothing ever makes a difference anyway, so nothing will change. So that while you all vote on that, let's just bring up two questions from the audience that are basically along these lines. So the first one here, says, what about if you're an employer, how does an employer deal with the fact that they might be worried that there's basically full-time childcare going on while they're working? This is like, basically, let's just broaden this into like, how do you trust people to do it? Now, hopefully the schools will stay open for a start, so that will help. But basically, how do employers wrestle with, like, are they getting? And then a second one for you, Minister, which is, you are very perky about remote working, that it is smashed through presenteeism. What about the PM, given that he's pretty keen on the whole, could you all get back to the office shtick? Or at least he's had a bit of both, but he's had phases of being like, more, could you please get back to the office? So while you have a ponder on what we think about what the Prime Minister thinks, Emma, what do you think on the poll and on the challenges?
So for starting, the challenges around childcare, I think, again, we've got to be a little bit careful. There was a sort of subtext to that question, that everybody's got their kids running around at home and sort of working and sort of not. And I don't actually think that's what we're seeing at all. I think what we're seeing are, and let's just bring men back into this conversation. Men look after kids. It's not childcare. They look after their kids. So men and women juggling how to look after their kids and elder parents and working. What is brilliant about remote working is you can drop the kids off at school, come back and be at your desk. You can take small chunks of time out in order to be able to do that. You don't necessarily have an hour and a half commute. This is what we're seeing certainly in the cities and in rural communities, where you're having to pay for childcare to sit on a train or a bus. So there are some real benefits, but actually what we need to get right is the point about trust. We need to trust people who we cannot see to know that they are going to be able to do their jobs. What we also need to get right is the synchronicity of work, and that is complex, which is if we have people working remotely, we have to know that there are touch points where they can connect as teams, and actually we have to start to open up a conversation around how work and life collide to ensure that teams themselves are able to make that work. So you may be starting at 6 and finishing at 4, you may be starting at 10, you may be doing some combination in between. But getting those conversations about how we design jobs in teams right is going to be really beneficial. But we have to start from a point of trust, and the businesses that do this well, and let's face it, there are a lot of them, start from that perspective.
What about the hard question? How's this going to play out for the future?
So I think it's too early to call on the gender pay gap, and I think or gender inequality is rising. I think there are some warning signs, as I said, but I don't necessarily think that we should assume that is going to happen. We need to see, and again, a lot of good businesses are doing this, planful action to ensure that people who are working from home are both men and women, and that they are supported and included. The answer is not to bring everybody back to the workplace.
Great, because it's probably not going to happen anyway. Mims, what do you reckon?
I think the reality is if you're a leader and you're sitting at home all week in your garden room and expecting everyone else to do something different, that's what we need to tackle in the way that Emma's just described, that actually we're keeping teams together, we're keeping people motivated, but actually we're building on the positives of hybrid working. And we're also being careful that we're, yes, busting through presenteeism, but we're not sliding into being at work non-stop. And I'm really pleased the HSC is doing, you know, work around, you know, good mental health and good well-being and that risk around work, so we can keep people in the labour market longer. So, you know, as I said earlier, if it's, you know, working at home, living at work non-stop 16, 17 hours to make the point that you're, you know, not there, you know, that's not healthy either. So I think it's just about that balance of let's get the economy back going. Let's take all the good bits. Let's, you know, pick up on the challenges. Let's make it more inclusive. Let's try and tackle the gender pay gap and the disability inequality in terms of opportunities, and those people who are continually left behind. There is no excuse to leave people behind now who could be in the labour market. So if we can take the best of all the good stuff that's been thrown at us with COVID, then we're going to continue to have that agile, brilliant labour market and try and actually battle down some of those very long-term troubles in there we've never been quite able to come to meet before.
Great. OK, let's just bring up the results of the poll and then release everyone to their really cold days. So what did you all think was going on for the gender pay gap? The results are... Well, I mean, there's a slot that you are all nihilists, so it's going to have no effect. Although I have to say, it basically has the same answer as Emma, which is like, who knows, why don't we wait and see? And in the end, that's about employers making sure we get the right answers along the lines of what you've just been all mentioning. Now, we should all say thank you to the panel for all their contributions this morning. Thank you all for coming, whether via the Zoom land or whatever it is, YouTube, and those of you that are here in person. We're very grateful. And can I just say thank you again to the Health Foundation for supporting the survey that underpins this research, and the Nuffield Foundation for supporting all 2 years of the Economy 2030 inquiry. Have a good day, everyone, and we'll see you at a Resolution Foundation event soon.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.